It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
Museum without walls, so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're going to be talking about star trail shooting. And if you don't know what that is, that you will by the end of the time we have our hour. And we'll look at using modern cameras, how we can shoot and see things that beyond what our eye can actually see. Where we might be able to best see something like the Orion Nebula or the Andromeda Galaxy. And we'll also explore the idea of how we may be able to use poetry with this. So as we go along, we're looking forward to it. Krista?
I'm Dr. Krista Longton, an Associate Professor of Communication Studies at IUPUI and an Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Today, we have two great guests with us, Dr. Andy Gavrin, who is a physicist, and Dr. Frederick Kleinhans, astrophotographer. And we'll go ahead and get started, I think, by just hearing a little bit more. And Fritz, maybe we'll start with you and tell us a little bit more about the idea of star trails and how you fit into this concept.
Okay, many people are impressed by star trail pictures. They're just pictures of the sky at nighttime where the stars are arcs. And in talking with one of our other colleagues, Joyce, I think she didn't realize one important thing about star trails. The stars move across the sky just the way the sun moves across the sky, and that's because the Earth is spinning. It's the same thing for both. And if you think about it, if you took a look at the sun for 10 minutes, does it move very far in the sky? No. It takes hours to see the sun move in the sky. So if you want to take a nice star trail picture, plan on being out there for several hours.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Fritz, that's really great. And building on that, one of the things that amazes me is that I bet you most of us think that that's the star moving across the sky. I think we get that the sun, the Earth rotates in the sun. Maybe we've gotten that enough in our schooling to get that. But I bet you a lot of people are fascinated by those star trails because they think those stars are moving.
They think the stars are moving, or they don't realize they're moving for the same reason that the sun moves. I think it's a totally different phenomena at nighttime than it is in the daytime. And maybe don't even realize there's different stars. See, the other funny thing is we see the sun every day, but at nighttime we see different constellations at different times of the year. And that also is a little bit of a curveball for somebody who's not paying attention to the sky.
But of course, Fritz, that means, for instance, that all the stars also rise in the east and set in the west, right?
As long as we're living in the northern hemisphere. Uh-huh. Let's see, they still rise in the east in the southern hemisphere, but that's on your other hand. Everything's upside down there. It's a mind twister if you think about what the sky looks like for most Australia or New Zealand.
Right, and they have a different constellation map at the same time we do up here, or have one. So That's again because of thinking of it as a sphere, which ancient people used to think, right? That there was a sphere of a sphere surrounding us.
Yes. In fact, there were multiple spheres. And so we talked about the music of the spheres because I guess they slid over each other. There were glass spheres with the stars pasted on and the planets pasted on. Can you help me out here, Andy? Know your ancient history?
Oh, not very well, but yeah, there were spheres within spheres. And part of that, I guess, had to do with explaining the retrograde motions of the planets.
That's part of the sphere story, yes.
And then once some of the other planets were observed to have moons, they needed to add another layer of spheres. It was getting very complicated.
But I think even out amongst the stars, there were these celestial spheres that were multiple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so one thing that I think too, Fritz, that would be confusing is I would guess that most people don't realize that in the daytime the stars are there.
That is correct. Of course, you can, yes, if you have a computerized telescope, you can have it find stars in the daytime. If you're a camper out in the woods and wake up early, I've done the following. I've gone out and found Venus as the morning star in the early twilight, and I've just stood there while the sun comes up. And as long as I have Venus right next to a leaf on a tree, I can still know exactly where to look with my eyes. And you can see the planets in the daytime. Anybody can. The fascinating thing for me about what is the typical person's misunderstanding is when you talk about the star Polaris, many people say, well, Polaris should be easy to find. It's the brightest star in the sky. Well, maybe not. Maybe it's like the 30th brightest star in the sky.
Wow.
Yeah.
A lot about misconceptions already. And I'm wondering, Andy, as a teacher, as a public scholar, I imagine you spend a fair amount of time kind of talking with folks about some of these misconceptions. Can you talk a little bit about how you talk with folks about, sort of what things are even when we can't see them?
Well, that's true. I think a lot of people have various misconceptions, misunderstandings about how things work in the world. And talking about it is definitely part of my job. One side of that is just sort of the normal day-to-day thing. You know, you run into somebody in the grocery store, in a restaurant, you're chatting with friends, and they ask, you know, is such and such a thing true? And the answer is, well, not exactly. You've got it partly right, but this other part is a little different. In the classroom, though, it's serious business because it can make the difference between a student being successful in what might be a difficult class and being able to catch on and learn some new things. It turns out that if people have an idea about how things work that's incorrect, it's much harder for them to learn what is correct than it is if they don't have any idea at all. So finding the things that people misunderstand frequently is part of the job of really understanding how to teach. On the other hand, it's also important to remember that a lot of people do have a lot of good ideas. And it's important to recognize when somebody's got something half right, that doesn't just mean that they're half wrong. It also means that they are half right. And learning to build on the parts that they do understand is also an important part of this. So I don't think we should dwell too much on what people don't know. We should remember that people also know a lot of things too.
Yeah, and that gets to the fundamental question of that for both of you, and that is that people do know a lot more than we sometimes realize. And so part of that is actually asking them rather than being in the mode of teaching them. In other words, I think it is about trying to find out where the learner is in terms of their knowledge base. And they may not use the same words that we're expecting, but they have the concept. And so that I think that's really important too.
I have to say, I'll go into politically unsafe territory. I feel like I failed as a teacher over the last 30 years because of the incredible things people believe about COVID-19. As a scientist, I think, or as communicators, we have a real problem trying to help people distinguish truth from craziness.
Well, that is true. I do agree with you.
One of the things that I think can sometimes be powerful in those conversations is to look for ideas or even sort of values or perspectives that we share. So for thinking about, you know, the idea of photos as a sort of point of wonder, even if we disagree, you know, even if I have a misconception that using a visual image or using something that might start from that place of wonder can sometimes be a helpful tool in kind of getting someone to engage in a conversation where they might be apprehensive or may have misconceptions. So I'm wondering about how your experiences with photography have shaped your conversations with folks about this.
First, I'll put in a little footnote. Astronomy textbooks drive me crazy because sometimes they show real pictures of astronomical objects and sometimes they show artists' impressions. And oftentimes that's in the fine print or not even mentioned. I really think it's important for people to understand this is a real picture or this is some artist's conceptualization. The other thing I have as an astronomy teacher is people send me emails all the time with amazing pictures. Did you realize when you're up in the Arctic, here's this beautiful view of the sun and the moon and Mars as big as the moon? And it's obviously some Photoshop nonsense. And it's amazing to me that people I think are fairly smart are easily fooled by, and in fact, we see that right now in the Ukrainian war. We see that on Russian TV, they show real footage and then they have in big bold red letters in the corner, fake. So real footage is being labeled as fake. And they say now you can take somebody and actually give a moving image of them, which is fake, but looks so real it's hard to detect. And so it used to be a picture, you know, a picture didn't lie. That's no longer true. That's scary to me. It used to be if you had a picture and it was a pretty good representation of what might have been. We can't trust that anymore. And a lot of people are gullible.
Right. I think, you know, Fritz, you're hitting on a part of this whole idea of seeing and what's there and seeing beyond. And it occurs to me every time I have taken my telescope out, and granted, it's not a huge telescope, I get really disappointed because what I see in there is really small. and so, you know, I'm expecting to see these big pictures, you know, like I want to see huge things, and I'm not. I mean, they are, do you know what I mean?
I experienced that just 2 weeks ago. I was in Florida doing astronomy, and there was a young man with a new telescope. He was excited to see things in the sky, and he kept on complaining to me. It's so small. It's so faint. For me, a critic, and it's true for all amateurs, the critical thing is to understand what you're seeing. When I look at the Andromeda Galaxy, I can't see near as much detail as in a beautiful picture, but it's fascinating to me. If we're not alone in the universe, there's probably people there in the Andromeda Galaxy looking back at me. There's amateur astronomers there looking back at me with their telescopes. We're looking at each other. We just can't see each other. Or I photographed some quasars last week that are at a distance of 8.7 billion light years. The light left them before the universe was half its current age. On my photograph, there are two tiny specks of light. They look like stars, but in fact, they're the cores of remote galaxies. So if you see those and don't know what they are, it's like, oh, it's just a double star, who cares? But once you know that that light left before the universe was half its current age, so you have to know what you're seeing. And it's just like, to me, it's the following thing. Which would you rather do? Would you rather go to the museum and see a lion, or say you see a fox that's stuffed and right in front of you and you can look it up close and see the details? Or would you rather be out at Eagle Creek Park and just catch a glimpse of a fox in the twilight, maybe just its tail, the real thing versus the picture?
So when that begs the question. So when you do your photography, Fritz, then are you able to enlarge the image beyond what you could actually see with the lens of the telescope?
With my telescope, which has a 10-inch diameter mirror, I can photograph things probably equivalent to what I could see with a 100-inch diameter mirror telescope. No amateur has a telescope with a 100-inch diameter mirror. So it really it's incredibly more powerful than what the eye alone can see. Plus, the eye, when looking at faint light, can't see colors, but your camera can see colors. So I get colors in all the objects I photograph, and it's only the brightest objects in big telescopes. I mean, I've seen the red of the Orion Nebula through a telescope. That's beautiful. I've seen the blues in the Ring Nebula with a big telescope, but it requires a big telescope visually. So yes, and partly, you know, old guys like me, I have a dear buddy in California. We exchange emails every week. His vision's gone bad. He can look at a computer screen up close, big, and see the object he's photographed. If he tries to see it through the telescope, he can't see anything. So part of this is making up for our old eyes. And also, we live in a more and more light polluted universe. And the camera can better penetrate the light pollution than the eye can. And so that's another factor. It just makes our eyes much more powerful. I mean, all professional astronomers take pictures. When photography came in the late 1870s, astronomers immediately switched to photography. It's just so much more powerful than looking, except maybe for planetary detail. That's survived up until 20 years ago, maybe.
So this is really a fascinating thing, Fritz. I suspect, I just want to put it in a nutshell, what you just said is that when observing or you know, when capturing an image through your using astrophotography and a telescope and a good camera, in a way the camera is doing as much work as the telescope is in terms of what you can finally see at the end.
Yes, you might even argue that camera is more powerful than a telescope. I mean, the camera can see things 50 times or 100 times fainter than the eye could see through the same telescope. So It's not a multiplication of two or three or four. It's a huge multiplication. So you're right. The camera is a key. I mean, it's the biggest CCD cameras in the world, I think, are owned by astronomers. Astronomers have CCD cameras in their telescope that are like 2 feet square and have billions of pixels because they really want to see the sky.
So that's why, you know, so that makes some sense in that, you know, when I watch something at very high resolution on a television, you know, and they're trying to get more high resolution, why it doesn't look exactly like what my eye would see, which I think is interesting. There's more details showing because it's caught being captured through a camera that can see much more than I can see, down to every little blemish and everything that's in there sometimes. But that's really amazing, Fritz. Have we seen a change? Does digital make it even more powerful than we did when we had film?
Digital is incredibly more powerful than film because for a 1 second picture, film and digital are, let's say, comparable. But film, if you try to take a 5 minute, a 10 minute and 1 hour picture, film just goes bad. It starts to lose its ability to collect light after an hour. It's called reciprocity failure. Film just, to use a street word, craps out. The digital camera does not do that. And so digital has, I'll tell you what digital does. With an amateur telescope and a digital camera, I can beat what the Mount Palomar 200-inch telescope, the largest telescope in the world was, like even up until the late part of the last century. Any amateur with a good telescope and camera can beat what Mount Palomar did on film. That's how huge a difference it is. Wow. So the pictures I take today with my telescope and my camera are better than all the pictures in an astronomy textbook from 40 years ago.
And so here's what's hard for me, but I would assume you only then see that in when you actually look at it on the screen. You aren't going to see that in the digital camera because you're still seeing like you are. Am I right?
If I typically these days I take pictures of 2 hours duration. And I do that by and I do that by taking 24 or 5 minute pictures. And so you're right, if you know a camera has a live view function, you can't see anything. But in that 5 minute sub exposure, I can begin to see the faint outline of my target. And then, but it's noisy. But then over 2 hours, I get better color fidelity and much less noise. So actually I do see the picture accumulating as I take it. And this is interesting, talking about seeing. Because electronic equipment is so much more powerful than the eye, there's something now called electronically assisted astronomy, EAA. And so there are people, and this is wonderful for public outreach. People have a telescope and they have a digital camera, which just accumulates for perhaps a minute or two. And it can, from the city or like, yeah, from the suburbs, from the outer, you know, from the ring around the city, one of these EAA setups can capture the Andromeda Galaxy or the Ring Nebula in detail and in color. And people can look over your shoulder and see the image there. And you can go to 10 or 20 objects over the course of a night. And it's really changed public outreach. It's the pictures you want to see when you look through the telescope. If you buy an EAA rig, in fact, some people have gone so far as to build it all into the telescope so that when you look through the eyepiece, you're actually seeing the accumulated image. And we all have a smartphone. It transmits that image that you see in the eyepiece to all your friends standing around you with their smartphones, so everybody can share in that experience. So these things are only about $3,000, and you can talk to me later and I'll tell you where to send your money.
That's amazing. I mean, Andy, the optics in this, I mean, what's going on? There's digital electronics, optics.
It's fascinating. It's all kinds of stuff. I mean, a lot of it, it starts with the CCD, which is the image recorder. It's the part of the camera that is doing the same job as the retina in your eye. Then there's the computer is playing a big role, because what it's doing is it's storing data and it's averaging out the noise, which would be there if you tried to take a very short exposure. And it's adding it up and forming the image over time. And once the image is there, it's already there on the computer. And then all of the existing computer technology like wireless networking and Bluetooth can be used to share that image with the people who are around or to a big screen that's on site. And it's fascinating. And by the way, I'd just like to note that we're here on radio and we're talking about these things, but Fritz has donated some absolutely stunning astrophotography that he's done to the physics department at IUPUI. And we have poster-sized images up in our main office suite in our conference room that are stunning. I mean, they're much better than anything that a professional astronomer could have done, you know, in my earlier adulthood. And now it's something that, that can be done. And Fritz puts a tremendous amount of time and care into creating those images, and they're just gorgeous.
Thank you, Andy. I'd like to say something in defense of the human eye, because we're talking about how powerful electronics are. In fact, for short, for things happening in real time where you're only looking for a second, the eye is virtually as good as the best detectors if you're only looking at something for a second. The eye can actually see single photons entering it. And for planetary work, up until very recently, the eyes were better than any camera. And so the human eye is an incredible device. The only limitation it has for astronomy is the inability to collect photons over 5 or 10 or 20 minutes or an hour. That's its key limitation that is overcome by our new electronic gadgets. And I just have to mention, if you're interested in the details, astronomers and certainly people with cameras that they use every day are using CMOS detectors, which are slightly different technology than CCDs.
This is actually an unusual thing. You know, Fritz, I just realized this, but traditionally we've thought of computers as being, you know, better or worse than humans at various kinds of tasks. And traditionally, computers are best at doing things very fast. This is an unusual situation in which the computer allows us to do things more slowly and thereby gains an advantage.
Yes, yes, for sure.
Yeah, and I would think that, you know, looking at the human anatomy and the way it works with the eye, we have a couple things that would make it, what you were saying, Fritz, make us an advantage when we look quickly, because we are really kind of programmed to be able to detect a lot of stuff in a quick kind of fashion to protect ourselves.
Yeah, to save the tooth daggers.
Right, but that thing, that same ability, though, is a lot of times our eyes won't stay in the same place. You know, they move. And so even if we could get our brain programmed somehow to be able to look for a long time and store all that, adding up the images, it's like the computer and the camera does, our eyes still might not comply, because it's not going to be able to hold it for that, you know, as focused that way.
The chemistry of vision that's happening in the eye doesn't have the ability to store up that signal over time, even if you could stare at one spot.
And even if you could make your brain learn to record it that way. So,
although, you know, this just an interesting little footnote. One of my favorite games, and many people's games, I think, you know, we have the little, what's the nursery rhyme about who sees the first star in the night gets their wish?
Yeah.
It's fun to be out at twilight looking for the first star to come out. And those of us who are amateur astronomers have an advantage because we know where the bright stars are in the sky. But a key point in being the first one to detect those bright stars is when you're looking at a blank blue sky, your eyes tend to flit around. And when I try to look for a particular star where I know it's in that location, because I saw it last night after dark, I have to force my eyes to stop flitting around and very carefully scan the sky slowly in that region. Because you're exactly right. The eye starts scanning when it doesn't see anything. So it's a little trick for those of you who want to be the winner of who can see the first star tonight.
Oh, I love our tricks. We've been talking with Andy Gavron and Frederick Kleinhans about really, I think, photography and astronomy and how we take pictures of that and how we can see beyond the what our eye can see. Also, we've been talking about the human eye, which is fascinating. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise, and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
I'm Krista Longton, and today we're having a conversation with Andy Gavron and Frederick Kleinhans about star trail shooting, about photography, what we see and what we can't see. And as we were going to the break, I was interested, Andy, both you and Fritz, you as well, you know, kind of talked about this notion of, as you were taking a photograph, being able to kind of remove some of the noise out of the photograph. And that concept of noise, I normally think of as auditory noise, things that I can hear. But in this case, you're talking about sort of visual stuff that might get in the way of taking the photograph. Is that right, Fritz? Can you explain that to me a bit?
When we talk about visual noise, two things come to mind. Those who are old enough to remember pictures taken on film, I'm sure have seen very, what we'd call grainy pictures, where there's just a lot of, you know, particularly sports photographers in the past, modern digital cameras are so good that you don't often see noise. I'm fascinated in this seeing concept by the following thing. Visual observers are now seeing stuff through their telescopes that was considered impossible to see 10 or 20 years ago. And how are they doing that? They're using big telescopes, but they're going to very dark places. They're waiting for nights when the air is very, very steady, and they've trained themselves so that as they look, they may only see the very faint object they're interested in literally 20% of the time. And that's tricky when you're looking at something through your telescope. You want to see it all the time. And if it starts to disappear, you don't trust yourself. But as you train yourself, the best observers can be confident they're seeing something at the 20 or 30% level. They just see it for a fraction of a second every 3 or 4 seconds, and they know they've seen it. So that's a different kind of noise where the image kind of comes in and comes out. So those are the two things that come to mind for me when you talk about visual noise. Maybe Andy can give us some other examples.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so I think of it in terms of visual static. So if you're old enough, you remember seeing the TV after the station went off. You just get a screen full of black and white pixels, as it were. And I see that, you know, I don't do much astrophotography like Fritz does, but I do a lot of photography. And if you're trying to take pictures, particularly in the twilight, when there's not really enough light to get a good image, you do see that still, where if you look closely at your photograph, it might be blurry around the edges of things, but also there's this speckliness that comes from some of the individual pixels being, you know, a little brighter on average than they might have been, and some being a little darker just because it's not getting enough light. I see we've added somebody here.
Yeah, one of our guests was able to join us. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Mark. Hi, everybody. Sorry I'm late.
That's okay.
It's okay, so, Joyce,
we're right live talking about images and how we see, and I'll bring you in a minute, but Joyce is going to help us. Joyce is a professional poet. This is Joyce Brinkman, and I'll bring you in just a second, Joyce. So enjoy our conversation. So Andy, go ahead with what you were saying.
Well, no, I think I was pretty much done. I was just talking about the speckliness of an image. That's really what we mean by noise. When there's lots and lots of light, the camera can get plenty of information about exactly what the color and brightness is at every little spot in the image. But when there's not enough light there, it doesn't really get a good reading yet. So there's some speckliness that we call noise introduced into the image.
I'm thinking about on my end, when I try to zoom in too far on my iPhone, right? Mm-hmm. I have the option to kind of use that zoom feature on my iPhone. And when I try to zoom in, when it's slightly dark outside and I try to zoom in too far, and that thing that's far away, maybe I'm at a concert and want to, you know, take a picture of Taylor Swift all the way on the other end of the Lucas Oil Stadium, right? That, mm-hmm. You know, that she looks a little bit grainy. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about visual noise, that sort of graininess that makes it hard for us to see. And that makes sense that when we're talking about, you know, astrophotography, the idea that concept of noise is really critical to being able to see or get in the way of seeing the things that you want to see.
Right.
There's some other interesting examples, I think, of visual problems. Everybody who's old knows about cataracts. When you're driving down the highway and a car is coming toward you, in addition to the headlights of the car, you see light flaring all over the place. In a way, that's a kind of noise that prevents you from seeing clearly what's really there. Another example, if somebody shoots a flash camera off in your face, you have a little momentary afterglow. Mm-hmm. Or there's these visual tricks. If you stare at a green image for a long time and then you look at somewhere else, you'll see a blue overlay. There's a lot of artifacts that can happen with our vision. Or, you know, those who study the psychology of vision could have a long list of how our eyes produce artifacts, which are a kind of noise that prevent us from seeing what's really there.
And so, Andy, this is really interesting because optics also have those. We've talked about optics in the past on the show, and they also have those kinds of things happening in the lens of the camera. But it's the digital, it's the computer part behind that's able to do something with that.
Right. So any instrument is going to have a certain limit to what it can observe. That's true of film cameras. It's true of digital cameras. It's true of all kinds of different spectrometers and other fancy gadgets that we have in the various science research areas. When there's very little signal, you don't get a very good image or spectrum or whatever you're trying to record. And computers have been a huge boon to scientists because they allow us to do some mathematical statistics essentially in real time to average out that noise. Often if you can't make a good observation in 1 minute, well, you can make 5 1-minute observations and take the average of them. And I think a lot of people learned in science labs in school about doing multiple trials and taking averages. But what a computer can allow you to do is take hundreds or thousands of trials and take averages automatically and be showing the scientist the result of all that trialing and averaging to get really good data extraordinarily quickly, or in a really dim, a low light situation or a low signal situation over a long period of time to get an observation that never could have been made at all. So computers have really changed the game in a lot of areas of science in that way.
Yeah, and that's just that the idea that it can just be able to just improve something just that much better in terms of what's there, you know, by resampling or sampling more times, like you said. Or I think, Fritz, I even think about, you know, how cameras today, the iPhone can do this with HDR image, which is meaning it's averaging. It's taking multiple images, it's averaging them together and giving you a better image in the end.
It's incredible what phones have been able to do. I don't think people 10 years ago would have realized that. If we have time, there's an interesting astronomy application that deals exactly what we were talking about here.
I'll go ahead.
The Hubble telescope is used to take pictures of the planets sometimes, and that's maybe a quarter of a second picture. Amateurs on the ground take pictures that look almost as good as the Hubble with just little telescopes. And how do they do that? They put a video camera on their telescope that maybe is only, you know, 10 inches in diameter mirror or lens, and they'll take like 1,000 video frames in just a couple minutes. And those of you who've ever looked through a telescope know that the image kind of shakes because of the atmospheric turbulence, which is the same thing as you see down a blacktop highway in the summertime on a hot day. Oh, everything shimmers in the distance. The planets shimmer when you try to look at them. So you take 1,000 video frames in 2 minutes and you give them to the computer, and the computer goes through and throws out all the blurry ones, saves the sharp ones, lines them up so they exactly sit on top of each other and sharpens them. And now that amateur can take a picture of the planets comparable to what the Hubble can see. It's the same averaging thing Andy talked about, but now we're not trying to accumulate a lot of photons. We're trying to take pictures real fast and pick out the sharpest ones.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask a question. I'm sorry, Mark. So when we're talking about averaging, are we really taking the best ones and putting them together, which enables us to see what we might otherwise not see?
Exactly. Take 1,000 pictures, throw out 700 of them, keep the best 300, stack them up to enhance the detail, and then digitally sharpen them. And you got an image that matches Hubble pretty near.
So Joyce, you have this real love for astronomy, planets, stars, and all that. But you have this real skill and ability to turn things like that into words through poetry. So I'm curious, what gets you so inspired about planets and stars and those things in your poetry?
Oh, Mark, I think if you have, if anybody has the opportunity, excuse me, to read my poem, wait a minute. Let me get my throat cleared here. If anyone has the opportunity to read my poem that's down in the Circle Center Mall right now, I think that poem is maybe the answer to it. It's called First Impression. And I wrote it because I can remember when I can actually remember being held as a toddler, looking out the apartment window, having my parents, hold me at the apartment window and looking up at the stars and the moon. And I can remember when I was, you know, walking and only just as high as the window sill, but I would go to the window and again, just be intrigued with the stars and the moon. So it's just been a lifelong thing with me. That I have noticed. And it's like a lot of things in our world. I mean, some people notice, some people look up, and certainly through the ages, there have been a lot of different people in different cultures who've looked up at the heavens and thought about things and drew pictures or wrote words. But then a lot of us kind of go through our busy lives and never really notice those things. And I sort of feel that same way about a lot of the non-human world here on Earth, that some of us really notice and others it's all there, but they just, for whatever reason, have never focused on that. So since we're talking about cameras and telescopes and so forth, I think it's just a matter of what you get focused on. And I can just remember from a very young, early age that I had been focused on looking at things in the heavens.
Wow. And then, Joyce, how do you then translate, and I've always wondered this, but how do you translate something that you visually have seen into language of poetry?
Well, usually if I'm in, when we're talking about something I've seen, that's something that I've been inspired by my eye. I think as a poet, I can get inspired in different ways. Sometimes I'm inspired through my ear because I'm hearing something and that brings words to mind and I start, you know, connecting them to other words because of the music of those words. With something where it's my eye, it's still what the words, the words that eye brings to, that comes to my eye from that object. What those words are that come to me, but they are just, I would say, the words that object brings to mind and inspires. And I would be a better poet. I can tell you, Mark, I would be a better poet if I had a greater vocabulary. I mean, vocabulary obviously is tremendously important in poetry because when you have a great variety in your vocabulary, you are able to express more and in different ways the things that you are gathering from the sight of the object. Does that help at all?
Yes.
Joyce, I think it's really powerful to help just to have the listeners kind of get a little window into your process, right? That you use to sort of think through things. And as you were talking, I was thinking about even in my undergraduate interpersonal communication classes, we talk about the perception process, the idea that, you know, we often have to make a decision as humans to attend to a particular stimulus around us, right? That we only have so much attention to give. And I think that as we're talking about, kind of what we see and what we can't see, and kind of that concept of, we were talking about visual noise earlier, it makes me think about how as a poet, one of the things that you're trained to do is to tune in really deeply into sort of one part or one, you know, one aspect of the perception process and kind of amplify it for us to kind of mix metaphors here, right? That you're, as a poet, you're sort of asking us to think really closely about a particular memory or about a particular object or a sound, as you mentioned earlier. And I think that for me, that's one of the things that is powerful about the relationship between art and science, right? Is that it sort of gives us an opportunity to see in different ways. And I'm wondering, maybe Fritz, if you have thoughts about that as you think about some of the photography that you've done over the years.
Well, the first thing I would say is I agree with Joyce. We all wish we had a better vocabulary. And as we get older, we start losing it rather than building it. Certainly, yes, yeah, seeing in different ways. I mean, it's what Joyce is doing is turning something she sees into words. And some people are more attuned to words than seeing. I think that's something we all need to do in this world is see in different ways. I mean, that's something that you could argue is wrong with our country right now. We're so politically polarized. If we could see the other person's point of view because something else is important to him, we all get so narrow in our thinking. It's easy to do. And Joyce is one part of it. Let's read something that visualizes in words what we saw. Or, you know, turning images into sound. We know there's what the symphony, what the planets by Holst, that's turning the planets into sounds. Mm-hmm. That's very powerful. I think it expands our mind to perceive things in different ways.
I you know, what we're talking about really is that intersection between art and science. Where you can see things in different ways because you do, but also the whole art of conversation, which is what we're doing here today. And we hope that you, as the listener, will at home explore further some of the ideas that we have presented to you, and that you'll have conversations with your family and friends. And we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with Andy Gavrin, Fritz Kleinhans, and Joyce Brinkman about using modern cameras to shoot beyond what the eye can see, including the Orion Nebula and the Andromeda Galaxy, and how anyone with even a small telescope can get great pictures nowadays. So we've had lots of really fun conversation around what we can see, what we can't see, and how seeing in different ways shapes our perspective. So as we were headed to the break, one of the things that we were talking about was the perception process, that all of us sort of see things differently and attend to things differently. Fritz, one of the things that you mentioned earlier is just how the equipment that we have access to has changed over time, and how kind of the average person can really take some beautiful pictures with not too much or too expensive equipment. So I'm wondering if we can start by talking about that a little bit, about how equipment has changed and your thoughts on kind of, if I wanted to take some pictures of Star Trails, what that would look like.
Sure. The first thing I would remind everyone is that Google's your friend. Anything you're interested in, Google it. Like Google astrophotography with my iPhone model 12, or astrophotography with my Samsung Android, you know, 29. It's true that in the last two or three years, high-end cameras have very powerful built-in capabilities. And so if you go to the cameras and root around in the instructions, you'll find information on how to take pictures under low light and dark conditions. I have an older camera. I'm an old-fashioned guy. I got an iPhone 7, which is like I don't know, 6 or 7 years old now. For older phones, you need to find an application. And there's an application called Nightcap, which I know is available for iOS operating systems, iPhones, and might also be available for Android now. Nightcap extends the camera's capabilities. And the limiting thing with a typical phone is you can maybe only take a 1 second exposure. You want to take a 10 second long exposure, and modern cameras can do that. Your iPhone with an application can do that. Now, remember, you can't hold your phone steady for 10 seconds. What I do is I take the mount in my car where I have my phone mounted on the dash so I can navigate. I take that mount from my car and I go out and I fasten it onto a fence post or something, because you got to hold your camera steady. With those little applications, in 10 seconds, you can take a picture of the sky showing as much as you can see with your eyes. Of course, you can see a lot more with your eyes if you drive out of town to where it's dark. If you're serious, get in your car and get out of town. Also, when you touch the phone to take a picture, you're going to shake it. Use the timer. Or if you're one of these modern people who talks to Siri and Siri talks to your phone, tell Siri to take the picture so you don't have to shake your phone while you're doing it. We talked about star trails. If you want to take a nice star trail picture, you have to hold your phone steady for a couple hours. And this application I mentioned, Nightcap, will take those star trail pictures for you over a couple hours. But guess what? Your camera's working hard now. You may want to have an accessory battery pack, or at least have a fully charged phone. The neat thing about phones is you can do a little bit of editing right in your phone. And most people know how to do that. And astrophotographs often require a little bit of editing. So it's interesting. If you have a point and shoot camera that costs you $100 or a more powerful super zoom camera, they can take much better pictures than your cell phone. But you do have to get that picture out of your camera into the computer and do a little bit of processing with it. You can do amazing things if you have a $200 point and shoot and put it on a tripod and take a 30-second picture of the sky. And again, Google's your friend. Google landscape astrophotography. It'll tell you how to do it. You don't need telescopes. You don't need mounts or anything. You just put your camera on a tripod. If you haven't got a tripod, set it on a pillow. Point it at the sky. Use a self-timer to fire it. Another thing you can do, if your neighbor's got a telescope, take your iPhone over, ask them to point it to the moon, and just hold your iPhone up to the eyepiece and capture a picture of the moon. Now, the fine print, you'll find extraordinarily hard the first time you do that, the center of the iPhone over the eyepiece. You're gonna have to come back every night for a week until you get it down. And then you'll get pictures that will amaze you. So that's just a little bit. If you want more, ask some more questions, but that's sort of a highlight of what's, and I should mention, there's a lot of this stuff is free. If you don't want to spend a lot of money on Photoshop, don't do it. There are free programs to process images, which will do a lot of the basic work for you in dealing with an astrophotograph. Now, I've got gear that I take pictures for hours. Now I have to have my camera on a mount that follows the sky. But again, there's cheap tracking mounts that only cost a couple hundred dollars that fit on a tripod, which would enormously extend what your point and shoot camera can do. Just don't jump in over your head. Some people try to buy a whole lot of expensive gear and they just get in over their head. I call it jumping into the deep end of the swimming pool without knowing how to swim and hoping you'll learn fast. Start on the waders, little kids' end.
Fritz, I did that first. I've been writing moon poems for a long time. And when I first was writing the moon poems, I decided I was going to go out and take pictures to go with those poems. And I went out and bought all this camera equipment. And I actually got a lens that was so heavy, I really couldn't hold the thing up. It was really bad. So I've already, it's very good advice that you're giving to people who are listening, because I've learned the hard way. I right now have a new, one of the latest Android phones and a Samsung phone. But to tell you the truth, I don't know. There are so many, you're right. There's so much stuff you can do with that thing. I'm not even sure what I need to be you know, what kind of thing I need to be working on. In other words, do I want the photo to be night? You know, that's obviously one of the options they give you, that you push the night button, and, or, you know, there are just all kinds of different ways that you can shoot it based on what's in that phone. So can you give us any kind of hint on something like that? Do I want to set my phone on night when I'm taking a picture?
What you want to do is turn on your computer, go to YouTube, and do a search for astrophotography with my Samsung and say the model number.
Okay.
And up will come a video, 5 minutes length, with somebody telling you exactly how to set your camera to take the pictures you want to take. Google really is your friend, and YouTube really is your friend. Amateur astronomers love to show you how to do what they do. There are hundreds of amateur astronomers making YouTube videos every week. There's a guy called, I don't know, the Crazy Greek in Japan. He's got a new video every week on how to take pictures. Really, you know, I can give you generic advice. Yes, you want to put your camera in night mode, but the best advice is to see somebody on YouTube who's telling you exactly how to use your camera.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, and I love the idea that you really can, Fritz, you know, this is back to that, you know, some of the most famous photographers in the world have used the phrase, you know, the best camera you have is the one you have with you, which is often now is our phone. And you might find yourself driving like I did one time in Albuquerque and driving down the highway, and the sky was so unbelievably clear and beautiful, and we were way away from the Albuquerque itself. And we just stopped and we got out, and I didn't have a cell phone then or a camera with me, but we marveled at the sky. But if I'd had my cell phone, oh my gosh, lying back on the hood of that car, looking at that sky, it was unbelievable what I was able to see.
I would recommend leaving your phone in your pocket and just laying back in
just
your car
and,
and watching for 5 or 10 minutes and absorbing it.
And then take it.
Because that's a very powerful experience to be in a dark place and look at the sky.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I have to agree. You know, I grew up in the city. I've been a city guy most of my life. But on those occasions that I've been able to get out to a dark place, sometimes it's on the coast, sometimes it's out in the desert, a couple times on islands in various parts of the world where there just isn't that much development and there isn't that much light. When you look up at the sky in a place that's truly dark, it is a totally different experience than looking at the sky in the city or in the suburbs. Even the clearest, most perfect night in Eagle Creek Park is nothing like the sky out somewhere 50 miles from Albuquerque or up in the mountains someplace. It's just extraordinary. And it's an experience for those people who haven't taken 5 minutes to just look at the sky in a dark place. You don't need a camera. It'll transport you.
That's
I would really, add really that good. If you don't know what you're looking at, Sky Safari or many other applications, you point your phone at the sky and it names the constellations for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that. I have one of those apps, Fritz, and it's really fun. I can point it down to the south, you know, down at the ground. And it shows me what's below the earth,
yeah.
On the other side of the earth, which is just way cool.
What is that called, Fritz?
I like Sky Safari. That's what amateurs use, but there's many such applications.
Yeah.
Okay.
We want to thank both of our guests. I mean, all three of our guests, sorry. Andy Gavron and Frederick Kleinhans and Joyce Brinkman for this incredible conversation. Krista?
Yeah. So until next time, I'm Krista Longton, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science. Thanks to all of our guests for being with us today.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.